KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Stanford lecturers Bill Burnett and Dave Evans teach one of the university's most popular courses. It's called Designing Your Life, and now they've turned the class into a book. And they'll join us to talk about how design thinking can help you achieve your personal and career goals and keep some of those New Year's resolutions. Join us for Forum. It's up next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. Design thinking has its origins in the world of product design. It's a process that has typically been used to solve problems and promote innovation in a business setting. It's also frequently associated with the design firm IDEO and its founder, David Kelly, founder of Stanford University's Design School. Today, a popular class at Stanford seeks to help students apply the concepts of design thinking to their own lives, theoretically leading to better ideas, greater productivity, and a fuller and richer life. The class is taught by Bill Burnett and Dave Evans, they've now turned their lectures into a book called Designing Your Life. Bill Burnett is executive director of the design program at Stanford, and Dave Evans is lecturer, management consultant, and co-founder of Electronic Arts, and they both join us in studio. And gentlemen, welcome. Good to have you both here.
Michael, good to be here.
Yeah, nice to be here. Thank you.
Thank you both. Let's begin by just talking about this notion. And by the way, this is, as I said, one of the most popular classes at Stanford. Before we were going on the air, I was saying I remembered, this may suggest a sea change to some of you, when I started teaching at San Francisco State, the most popular course in terms of enrollment was a course on human sexuality taught by a guy named Bernie Goldstein, who did great imitations of various animals, mammals mainly, in heat. But let me cut to the chase here. Most people would say, you know, you're talking about designing your life like an iPhone inventor designed the iPhone. On the face of it, they would at first blush think, well, this is typical Silicon Valley kind of thinking. You know, we're reducing things here. Reducing them to tech.
Yes. Well, it's not about the product. It's about the process. And the process is all about people, which is why they call it human-centered design. And Bill's good at summarizing that.
Yeah, we've been working on this idea of human-centered design at Stanford since the 60s, really. And it's the idea that you start with empathy, explore what people really need, and then through a process of iteration, prototyping lots and lots of ideas, you come up with these new innovations. So that's the process. And we just applied it to the most interesting kind of open-ended problem we could think of, which was what comes next in your life or what do you want to be when you grow up?
And you use many because this is not a mono pursuit. This is something that actually allows for tools to think of different plans, right?
Exactly. Yeah. All of us contain more aliveness than one lifetime permits us to live, as you were just commenting about yourself, Michael. So, we got to have multiple ideas to pick the one we're going to get to live at any moment in time.
And the moment in time, in many respects, may be in the future, but it may be now, both.
Of course. I mean, now is the reason design thinking works for this problem, by the way, is because of that relationship between the now and the then. We're trying to design this thing called my life in the future, a place none of us have ever been, a place that most of us don't have control over yet. And so we have to find a process that cannot analytically solve a problem because we don't know the answer. We have to empirically try things out. And so in the now, we take the best information we can get. And we do some experimentation process, we call it prototyping, to start crafting our way and building our way into the future. It's actually the only thing that works.
And it's also based on a kind of wisdom that says you got to improvise and you got to fail.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you think about innovation in the product world, right, there's lots and lots and lots of failed innovation before you come up with an iPhone. If you remember in the book on Steve Jobs' biography, they presented him the iPhone 3 times before they finally had one that was good enough. And so this notion of failing fast and failing with lots and lots of little simple experiments to sort of discover what's really going to work for you is something we borrowed from design, but it works really, really well in your life as well. And it demystifies this notion of failure. So many people are afraid to try anything because they'll fail. And we say, no, you fail fast so you can succeed sooner.
And I know you've said on a number of occasions you're not necessarily advising people how to lose weight or find the love of their life. But in many respects, you are talking about a plan or a roadmap or looking for meaning, really, is really underneath a lot of this, isn't it?
For most people we work with. Now, we have a toxic reaction to should, like you should live the more meaningful life. I mean, if you want to be a rapacious and thoughtless capitalist, you could technically use our methodology successfully. We would not recommend that personally. But we're not in the philosophical business of telling you which life to live. We're giving you tools to figure out the one you want. But overwhelmingly, what we find certainly with our students and our clients and now the thousands of people who've written back to us about the book is what people want is to live a significant life. They want to live a meaningful life. They want to live a life that matters.
Talking with Bill Burnett and Dave Evans, and their book is now out and available based on the course they taught at Stanford in the design school. And the book is called Designing Your Life. I couldn't help thinking in reading your book of Jean-Paul Sartre, who talks about this concept of bad faith. In other words, a lot of people do things because they think, especially when you're talking about younger people, the privileged kids who go to Stanford, a lot of them are indeed, they're talking about doing things for my parents want me to do this, or this is the practical thing to do, you know, or even when you get older into adult life, I got to do this because I got a mortgage on my head and it's scaring me and so forth, weighing me down. So the attitude in many people is, you know, find your dream and all that sort of thing. Just saw La La Land, in fact, which is really about that wonderful musical. Or do what you really want to do. And there's a real tug there, isn't there?
Yeah, there's obviously often a big gap between, you know, your sort of aspirational dreams for the things you want to do and what's actually practical. But I think with our approach, what we do is we say, look, start from where you are. Whatever you've got as an asset, your current and our students are graduating or you're in a mid-career and you're in the middle of a job, you can always find ways to make your situation better. Now, design is a fairly neutral sort of value system, but we always design to make things better, right? So we never design in bad faith to make things worse. So I think the notion is figure out where you are. That's why we say you write a work view and a world view or a life view. And then take that and see what's coherent in that. People, when they want a meaningful life, typically that means that who they are and what they do have to have some connection. And when if you've got those two things together, we call that your compass, you can start figuring out what you want to prototype next.
But you also, Dave, bring up this whole idea of conventional ideas, you know, shadow somebody, interview them, you know, do those kinds of things if you're looking for a job, even with respect to questions about people going into retirement. What am I going to do the rest of my life? You know, look at what's out there and just do the investigation that's necessary.
Yeah, get your hands dirty. I mean, we don't believe in hyper-simplified prescriptions, like do these three things and you're going to be fine. Life isn't quite that simple. But when pressed for the short version of this, we say, look, get curious, talk to people, and try stuff out. If I have to do a one-sentence version of it, that's really it. And the key thing is talk to people and try stuff out. Get out there in the field, out in the world, and talk to people. Not merely doing research like, oh, gee, if I – let's say we had to sit down and have a cup of coffee and tell me exactly what's involved in being a radio show host. You know, if I just get the facts from you, I've been in the shallow end of that pool. So how'd you become this person, Michael? How is it different being the radio guy than the author guy?
Well, there are people who come to me, for example, and ask to shadow me and so forth, and then they go into this realization that the job is not what they dreamed it would be. It involves a lot more work and so forth. Or, you know, there's a kind of pipe dream about a lot of things that we think about as life. You know, a lot of people want to be Hollywood stars or they want to be baseball players or whatever. The jobs aren't there in many instances, and we're talking about occupations that are very difficult or that you can't make a decent living with. Right?
Well, people are in agony about fantasies in most cases. Like, you know, I think I really want to be a doctor. I'm not really sure. I'm kind of, look, there is someone right now living in the future you're imagining. And if you learn how to have these what we call prototype conversations or prototype experiences, they become time machines. And you jump into a time machine and you blast off a little bit into the future and meet someone living the life you're imagining. This information is available and people are helpful.
All people have the luxury to design their lives and find their purpose? I mean, again, Stanford students are a privileged group of people, relatively speaking, time, money, opportunity.
Well, we've talked to lots and lots of different people in addition to the Stanford folks. And you know, by the way, about 70% of the Stanford students are on financial aid. So they're not all from a privileged class necessarily, but they do have lots of options in their lives because of the Stanford experience. But the mid-career people we talked to, blue-collar folks we've talked to, folks that, you know, have maybe less degrees of freedom, there's always something they can do. And again, our idea isn't that you're going to suddenly go from being, you know, the plumber to the famous radio host. That's not, it's not that kind of a transformation. How about just
plumbers
making...
do a lot better, by the way, anyway. Public radio host.
That's right.
Better hours.
Yeah, better hours too. But how about just being a better plumber or enjoying the things you do in your off time more? You know, finding ways. Martin Seligman is one of the positive psych guys. Said about jobs, it's not about finding the perfect job. It's about finding the job you can make more perfect. And I think it's the same thing with life. We're not talking about radical transformation. We're just talking about finding ways to design things in your future that will bring you more fulfillment and more meaning.
And again, Bill Burnett is Executive Director of the Design Program at Stanford, co-author of Designing Your Life with Dave Evans, co-founder of the Stanford Design Lab and management consultant, and co-founder of Electronic Arts and co-author of Designing Your Life. They're both here in studio with us. This is also something you emphasize. You talk a lot about personal agency or intimated, but it's team. You got to get a team together, really, and work, and there's a symbiotic process in finding who you are and your design for life.
It's really hard to do this alone. And one of the questions is, well, you know, is this really it? Well, how would you know? I mean, how do you know when you know, you know? That question comes up a lot, and we find you really need other people around you, if only to hear yourself. And getting feedback and hearing, you know, other people's reactions to your ideas. We're really not meant to live alone. We're not even meant to figure ourselves out alone. I mean, doing you all by yourself is almost impossible.
You don't have to be in agreement. We've got an atheist and a Christian here doing a teamwork together, right?
And exactly. Best partner I ever had.
Yeah. You know,
he's wrong, but he's the best partner I ever had. You know.
One of the exciting things, Michael, about the book now is that we have, you know, a couple hundred thousand people reading it, but we also are tracking about 150 design teams who have formed around the book, little book clubs that are doing this work together, and they're checking in with us on social media and asking questions. So people are really taking the suggestion of finding two or three other people to do the journey with seriously, and I think it's really working for them.
How do you measure the results of this? Do you have a metric in terms of success or are people finding a meaningful life? I mean, you've actually reached thousands of people, literally.
Well, there's two kinds of data, as you well know, being an academic. We have, you know, substantial anecdotal data, then we have rigorous data. And we're overwhelmed in the former, which is, I mean, so book sales, feedback, reports in from our website. So lots and lots of qualitative anecdotal data that this is making a difference for people. And so that's, you know, people signing up for the class.
Yeah.
So that's encouraging and it's meaningful. But of course, in a research point of view, that's not real data. Two PhD dissertations were done evaluating the efficacy of our intervention, as they would describe it, out of the School of Education and Psychology. And there we did parallel studies between students who took the class, students who signed up for the class but didn't get in, so they had the motivation but not the experience, maybe were just a placebo for the rightly motivated person, and students who couldn't care less and didn't even want to come. And sure enough, the data showed rigorously that actually taking the class empowers you to be more effective.
Talking to the authors of Designing Your Life, and they're here in studio with us, and we'll bring you, our listeners, into this with your questions and comments. A lot of I don't know if I call it jargon. That's often kind of a pejorative word, but a lot of words that you come up with, like reframing and dysfunctional and odysseys. And I mean, you've sort of developed your own lexicon here in some respects.
Well, some of it is comes right out of design thinking. And what we really stress in the book is if you want to, you know, you can read this book and you'll learn design thinking in addition to how to design your life. And one of the big things is the mindsets that designers employ when they're working. And what we've already talked about two of them, curiosity. Designers start by being curious about a situation rather than analytical. And this idea of reframing the problem. Because a lot of times people are working on a problem you just can't solve. It's too tightly constrained. So if you reframe it, you open up a whole new solution space. So reframing and a bias to action, this notion that we just do stuff rather than planning and trying to figure out your future. Just try three things and see which one works. So bias to action, reframing, you know, using it, having a team, you know, radical collaboration. These are all mindsets that designers use. When I was at Apple, this is how we worked. When I was, you know, running a consulting firm, this is how we taught our clients to work.
So the emphasis is on doing really here and being as opposed to the inaction, let's say.
It's bias to action.
Or musing and dreaming.
Absolutely.
Musing and dreaming, yeah.
You know, probably curiosity and bias to action are two favorite, you know, mindsets. You got to do stuff. You cannot think your way through this thing. We talk about design thinking as distinct from other kinds of thinking. And probably, you know, in the world at large, I would argue, and certainly here in Silicon Valley, engineering thinking, which solves its way forward, as opposed to design thinking, where we build our way forward. And in engineering thinking, you have all the data and all the equations you need. You can actually solve the problem with your pencil and a quadrille piece of paper and a calculator. You're good to go. In this life design stuff, it doesn't work that way. So you have to try things. And the feedback you're getting from this wonderful laboratory called reality, and if you're smart at design prototyping, setting the bar very low, and clearing it, and then doing it again, and do it again, and do it again. So we're trying to make this easier.
You know? Where does this sounds like almost a really ingenuous question in some way? Where does luck fit into all this? I mean, you know, you're kind of tripping through. Yeah. And
we can teach you how to do that.
We got a whole thing on being good at being lucky.
Right.
Dave?
Well, there's the business adage is, well, you know, it's good to be good. It's better to be lucky, and it's best to be good at being lucky. And some research actually indicates the correlation between the behaviors and people who come out lucky a lot. And it turns out to be peripheral vision and paying attention. So are you looking around and noticing what's going on around you and then inquiring into it while, of course, getting your primary responsibilities taken care of? You know, it's called we call it being good at being lucky. And it's an attention capability that is very learnable.
Well, you talk a lot with millennials, of course. What do I want to be? I say if I grow up, when they grow up, but also retirees have a certain advantage because, you know, they're out there with these responsibilities that young people don't necessarily have.
Well, and they have tremendous experience and tremendous assets typically. The thing they haven't had to figure out what they want to do next for a while, right, because they've been maybe in a career for quite some time. So
I hear this from so many retired people. You know, I mean, yeah, I like golf and I like gardening and I like cooking.
Yeah, it's not
enough. But, you know, I want something more than that. I'm giving up my identity to retire, and this has been my identity for all these many years.
Yeah, we talk about going from the money-making side to the meaning-making side of your life. Now, money is not so important, but you'd like to do something substantial or meaningful, and you've got 10, 20, you know, good years of productivity in you. And so we're hearing a lot from those sorts of folks. We did a talk at the AARP as well with their thought leader group about this idea of teaching people design as they're retiring. And I think it's a really easy set of tools for them to use to come up with something that is more meaningful than just playing golf all the time.
You haven't done a TED Talk yet? You should. I would say it's a natural for that. But
okay.
I'm inviting you. We had that.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
But I'm just wondering something, too, as someone who's been in higher education all my adult life, as a student and then as a professor, you think that higher education ought to include more courses that address these kind of personal questions and future plans of students? Because it's a little off the radar.
Well, you've just hit on our hidden agenda.
Yeah, you know, this is where we actually, I think, just
subversive
got lucky.
Agenda. Yeah,
I'm not sure we were even good at being lucky. When I first started planning on doing this, and Bill and I had some conversations back in 2007, I was talking with Scotty McLennan, actually, the former chaplain of Stanford, who I think you've had on the show before.
Had on the show and married some good friends of mine's kid. In fact.
And Scotty said, well, this is going to be great if you guys get this start. But, of course, as soon as they figure out what you're doing, they're going to run you off the campus because we don't do this kind of stuff around here. And 5 years later, he happily said, you know, I'm glad to announce I'm wrong. You mentioned the word sea change earlier. There has been a significant sea change that we caught the peak of the wave in higher education. Higher education, particularly in the secular world, the pluralist public university rightly didn't want to do the harm of manipulating your value system for you. And so stayed away from these kind of questions. We'd rather do it badly, not do it than do it badly. And so now what we found in design is an agnostic position that says, look, we're process guys. And we can help you find what's meaningful for you without telling you that answer. And the university has begun to work on that. And so this is a rising tide, social emotional learning, adult formation as part of the education, not just information, is starting to happen. And we're kind of the poster boys for that.
Yeah, there's a bigger debate here in some ways, though. I mean, we used to say to our students, those of us in the humanities who taught literature courses, and which have, you know, sort of gone down in many respects as enrollment and everything else, liberal arts education may not be certainly what it once was, but there's still an argument for that. But we used to say, you know, this study Shakespeare, be good for your mind. You make you think critically. It'll enhance you, all those kinds of things. Then you get back to students saying, well, you know, but if I go toward computer science, I'm going to have more STEM stuff. I'll have more likelihood of getting a job.
Right.
Studying literature is not necessarily going to, or history or philosophy is not going to, I love it, but it's not going to give me a job.
Well, we disagree. I think the notion that what you studied in school is tightly coupled to what you end up doing in life is not true. You know, 10 years out of school, only 25% of the people are doing anything that had anything to do with what they studied in school. So that's not even a connection that's true. But the other thing is a liberal education teaches you how to think and feel and discern what works for you. If you don't have those capabilities, our techniques aren't going to work because you're going to try a bunch of stuff and you'll dabble in a whole bunch of different things, but you'll never know what's the thing that fits for you. So we're strong proponents of a liberal education. I run the design program at Stanford, and I refuse to let it be more than about 2/3 of the undergraduate education because I want to make sure all of my engineering students take, you know, 60, 70, 80 units of fantastic liberal arts because that's how they learn to think and discern it. As a designer, if you don't have a sense of aesthetics, you can't be a good designer. Where are you going to get that if you haven't read Shakespeare?
And you mentioned Steve Jobs. That's something he really had, you know, that really promoted him in so many ways. The old cliche is follow your passion, but you're kind of saying follow your passions.
Well, or if you find them in time, enjoy them. Right now, one of our favorite dysfunctional beliefs is that the primary guidepost should be what's your passion? I mean, that I think by our anecdotal observation is the single most popular meta-narrative question to guide one's life is what's your passion, Michael? And the research and our experience both show the overwhelming number of people we work with don't have a good answer to that, which is either I don't know yet, or I may not even be wired to be one of those kind of people, or which one did you want me to tell you about first?
At least a liberal arts education would maybe open up some of those possibilities.
Yeah, so passion as a guiding light doesn't work for 8 out of 10 people. Now, if you discover we think passion's more outcome than input to most lives. So if you work hard enough to actually have a passion grow in you, then you get to reap the benefit of it. And there's not just one for most people.
We're talking, if you just joined us, with Bill Burnett and Dave Evans. They teach a very popular course at Stanford that has now become a book. It's called Designing Your Life. And let me open up our phone lines and invite you, our listeners, to join this conversation with any questions or comments you might have. It covers a pretty broad swath that has to do with, as we've been indicating, finding meaning in life and actually designing and finding a design for your life. And age is immaterial here. I mean, as they go into their book, they make you realize that these are concerns that people of all ages have. We've been talking about millennials on the one hand and retirees or potential retirees. But, of course, it often falls in the middle of life, too, that people are looking for a way to design their life. So let me invite you to join us, and you can do that now. Toll free, 866-733-6786. We welcome your phone call, so please feel free to join us. Again, the toll free number for your calls, 866-733-6786. And you are indeed welcome to join this conversation with any questions or comments. You can also reach us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and simply click on this segment. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @kqedforum, and you can go to our Facebook page. Lots of ways to join the program. And we'll hear from you when we return. We're going to a quick break here. This is all about how to design thinking and how it can help you meet your goals and keep your resolutions for the New Year's and well beyond. The authors, Bill Burnett and Dave Evans. Again, Dave Evans is co-founder of the Stanford Life Design, and Bill Burnett is executive director of the design program at Stanford. When we return, we hear from you. You're listening to Forum on KQED. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Stanford lecturers Bill Burnett and Dave Evans teach the university's one of its most popular courses, Designing Your Life. And the course shows students how to apply the principles of design thinking, often used in product development, to their own lives. And Burnett and Evans, founder of the design firm Adeo and Stanford's Design School, have published the lessons from the popular course in a new book of the same name, and the two are with us this hour in studio, sharing tips for developing better ideas, solving problems, and being more productive. And you can join us. We welcome your calls. Toll-free number 866-733-6786 or email us forum at kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Let me go to your calls. Let's begin with a caller from Palo Alto. Ryan, you're on. Hi.
Hey, good morning, guys. Hey, I just want to acknowledge you for doing such a great job and creating something that's actually spectacular, in my opinion. And the one note I have and something I've noticed listening to the conversation this morning is that it sounds like we got a lot of Tony Robbins framing and reframing, a lot of concepts that I've heard before. And what I'm wondering is, and I've kind of studied the Disney design techniques and so forth. You've talked a little bit about those type of things and those type of concepts. What I'm wondering is, what do you have to offer that's unique and original to the both of you, other than the framing of a class or the reframing? So in listening, I want to acknowledge you. Great idea. Offer this to the folks that are in school. But what's original? What have you created that's really from the soul of who you are that's spectacular that would make me want to buy and invest in your book? I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thank you for the question. And we should say design thinking is rooted in five core mindsets. We've touched on them: bias to action, curiosity, mindfulness of process, reframing, and radical collaboration. Those are all not original ideas. Those are all things you've derived, right?
Yeah. I'm actually hearing two themes in Ryan's question. One is what of the actual fabric of Bill and Dave, what of our, you know, authenticity has broadcast itself into our methodology, and then what's truly unique about it. I'll take the second one first. I'm not sure there's anything terribly unique about it. I mean, I think we, you know, this is a packaging of ideas we borrowed from other people. Like, we're standing on the shoulders of positive psychology. We're standing on the shoulders of history. Certainly all this design history that we've been involved in both as educators and product developers ourselves, with, you know, between 65 and 70 business years experience between us. So what we're mostly doing is collecting things together, aggregating them in a very coherent way, and delivering them in a way that people can make accessible. Our readers tell us two things.
You're synthesizing.
Yeah. They're telling us, number one, you know, I'm encouraged by this because I think it's doable. So making something doable so they can get traction is what we're primarily about. I'll let Bill answer how we're in it. I think we're in it mostly out of pain.
Well, you know, we both got terrible advice when we were in college, and no advice on how to form, you know, ourselves as human beings. So we just kind of – I muddled through. Dave did as well.
Right?
Yeah, they failed miserably. But I would say this. I've been on a lot of design teams. I was on the original Apple team that did the very first notebook computers, the PowerBooks. And I've been in a lot of design situations. And so what I think, you know, what I bring to this uniquely from my own experience is there's a moment in a design team where you're just lost. You don't have a good idea. All your prototypes aren't working. And you need to keep going. And so finding ways for our readers to just kind of – even when they think they're really, really stuck. And we've been doing workshops all over the country now. We've met people who, you know, on the outside look very successful. They're lawyers or doctors or something, but they say they're stuck and they're miserable and they don't like their lives. So finding a way to push through that to get to the very next thing, I think, is something that, you know, I've been part of, I've observed, and that's really what I'm trying to bring into the book, that sense that there is always a way to get unstuck.
And let me bring in some more of our callers. Let me go next to Ramin. Thank you for waiting. You're on.
Yes, good morning. Hi. I work for IBM, and we use IBM design thinking very successfully with interactive design. My question is, when you apply prototyping, more often than not, we realize that if it's not coupled with an agile methodology, it actually doesn't follow through. So, for example, sometimes the actual technology fails the very art of the possible. So how can you apply a proper methodology when it comes to life design thinking?
Yeah, let me take a whack at that. First of all, IBM is one of the companies in the world, one of the largest companies in the world, 440,000 people applying design thinking. And I'm sure you know Phil Gilbert down in the Austin Design Center. We work with Phil a bunch. You know, rather than getting into a definition of what's design thinking, what's agile, I think you're right. There, you can't just, you know, brainstorm and have lots of ideas. You can't just do empathy. You've got to have a bias to action. So everywhere in our book, the next step is do an experiment, run a prototype, do a prototype conversation, a prototype experience. If you don't apply action to this method, you're just thinking, and that's not going to get you anywhere.
Let me thank the caller. I'm going to go to some comments here. Pam writes, when one becomes a teacher, one does a lot of shadowing, observing, and talking to teachers in the field. While that observation is helpful, If I'd made my decisions based on that alone, I wouldn't have thought teaching was for me. Yes, I could see what the job was, but how I would do the job was different from anyone else I saw or spoke with. It's not enough to see what others do. One has to be able to combine observation with imagination. And Tara writes, I'm a 47-year-old Montessori teacher. Years ago, I created my own mission statement with characteristics. I wanted to embody a vision of daily life with 1, 5, and 10-year goals. I revisited every 6 months and reframe as necessary. I'm not particularly talented or lucky. I'm fairly poor, but these have not been huge factors. And here's a question from Ben who says, what are some solutions for reminding oneself why we chose a particular path or activity when we hit difficulties and or lack of inspiration?
Well, let me just tackle the first statement, which is exactly right. Observation coupled with imagination is right. What makes this work. You could observe, you go shadow a teacher and see how that teacher does what she does. But you may have a completely different reaction to, we're not saying I'll be just like her. It's like now I see what the teaching environment's like. Now I see what the classroom's like. Now I see how much is about planning, how much is about control, how much is improvisation. I would do it differently. So it's simply being in the space where people are having that experience to see if your own way of discerning and your own imagination are lit up by that situation.
This thing, you know, I want to be really clear. The first comment is quite accurate. You know, if you'd shadowed well, if you'd prototyped well using our terminology, does that guarantee a positive outcome? Does it guarantee you're going to get it right? First of all, we don't think there is one right. And does it guarantee? No, absolutely not. We make it very clear to our students and hopefully to our readers, look, we don't overpromise. I mean, there's a lot of overpromising going on in the world. We don't need to add to that. We have some ideas and we have some tools. And if you think with the ideas we offer that you decide are worthwhile and you use the tools that we offer that you decide will be worthwhile because you'll take a subset, you won't buy them all, and you live using those tools compared to not using those tools, you're going to be better off. Just imagining being a teacher is not as effective as having shadowed a little bit. Is it perfect? No. But we're trying to make it a little better. Life is hard. This is hard stuff. It takes some practice, but we're just trying to make it a little better.
We're talking again with Bill Burnett and Dave Evans, and they are co-authors of Designing Your Life. And here's another caller. Let me go to you in Palo Alto again. Joe, welcome.
Hi. Thanks for taking me. I guess my question for your guest is, how confident are they that a liberal arts education really will deliver on the intellectual and inspirational guidance that they believe? My own background, I went to Harvard years ago. And what I recall was that I took a very famous class in moral philosophy. And after hearing all these wonderful ideas, we were asked to write papers. I think the paper was about, should women be able to sell their eggs? And what I recall was thinking very deeply and then coming back in the next day, getting a C on the paper, and the TA telling me something like, you told me what you think. You gave me the answer you thought was interesting. All I needed from you was to know what other people thought, what other philosophers have thought in the past. And you realize that the liberal arts education I was getting, because the professors didn't really want to engage with the students intellectually, they just wanted to teach them and have them regurgitate information, was not really at all what I thought liberal arts education should have been. And are they sure that at Stanford, their students are actually getting what they really think they should be getting?
Well, I don't want to get into a Stanford-Harvard debate here, but it sounds like you had a bad experience. You had a bad experience in a class that wasn't structured the way I think a truly liberal education should be structured. So I'd be careful about judging, you know, from that one experience. Maybe you had others as well. I think the goals of a liberal education is to expand a person's mind and to make sure that they have many, many frames of reference to draw on when they're making their own decisions. And so I might assign a paper that asks you to regurgitate what, you know, Sartre said or what Hegel said. But that's just to make sure that you understand the information. If I were to assign a paper saying, what do you think? I would expect it to be a synthesis of not only what you've learned in my class, but what you've learned in life.
There's a big gap there between pedagogy and what it is pursuing, though, too.
I mean, yeah.
But even Harvard is growing. Perhaps since the caller went, there's a program at Harvard now called Reflections, which is a freshman seminar on looking at the grand humanist questions of life and what do they mean to you. So that's very different than what did they mean to them.
Right. Yeah, in the 60s, there was a lot of emphasis. I think maybe Bill has more memory of this than you do in your no insult to you, but I think you got gray in your beard, but I think he's got a few years on you. more up in my range. We used to talk about, is it relevant? You know, what you're teaching, is it relevant to the lives of students and to the politics that we're living under and so forth? And sometimes they got carried way to the extreme.
You know, 5 years ago, the head of undergraduate education at Stanford, Professor Harry Elam, came to us and said, we love the way you're helping seniors and graduate students figure out how to join the world when they leave Stanford. How about helping freshmen come to Stanford and figure out how to design their educational experience? So we now teach a course called Designing Your Stanford for freshmen and sophomores. And one of the questions we look at is, why are you here? What is your college view? We do work view as part of the compass for working people. We do college view for college students. The three classical answers. I'm here for the liberal education, learning how to think. I'm here to find myself. I'm here on the journey of self-discovery. I'm here to get prepared to make more money or have a good job. They're very different answers. We don't tell them the right answer, but we say, look, your chance of getting something goes up if you're just clear and intentional about it. So, you know, education is expensive. You better know what you're looking for.
Yeah, Harry Elam has a good deal of wisdom. Here's Ronna writes, I might have too many interests. It seems like I need a spreadsheet to make decisions. And here's a tweet from Nicole who says, I had to learn to let go of German ought to and move toward American explore. What a journey it has been. Again, those polarizations, nicely phrased. Here's Jake who asked, how does one bridge from a low-resolution concept, a sketch, to the trial product?
Well, that's a really good question. And again, you do it through a series of iterations called prototypes in product development. We make a very simple model to test a few ideas, and then we make a more complex model. Eventually, we're making what we call a high-resolution check model, the thing that models the exact product. I mean, when you're at Apple and you're going to make notebooks and you're going to make tens of millions of them, you got to make sure the one you've got in the lab actually works. I think you do the same thing in life. You start with the simple, you know, some interviews and some experiences, and then maybe become an intern for a month and see if that works, or something that's at a higher level of resolution. But this notion of having too many ideas and learning how to choose and then learning how to let go, there's a whole section in the book on that.
You got to wait till something ignites, too. And sometimes it doesn't come overnight, or it doesn't come if you push it.
No, it takes time. Hence the iteration process. In fact, we would recommend – I mean, having a spreadsheet is fine. You know, the weighted average columns and, you know, I've got choice number one, number two, number three, and I got my 15 criteria and weighting factors on each one, and I do the whole thing, and it comes out – this one, number one is – plan A is 71 points. Plan B is 68 points and Plan C is 82 points. Clearly, Plan C is much better. And then your soul goes, nah, I still like A. and so what's going on there is it's not just spreadsheets. And when there are too many choices, because your brain literally limits out at five or six, the counsel we give people is the best way to deal with too many choices is just cross off a bunch off your list and get it down to five or six.
And here's Marion who writes, well, I appreciate the expertise of your guests. It seems that doctors and lawyers don't need to reframe or restart or make life better as much as someone working three jobs to make ends meet. How do you reach out to communities who need to find opportunities? This sounds like it's solving first world white privilege problems.
Let me touch on that. It's a very fair question. We get asked this all the time. Isn't this just really for these elite students? I mean, they may not be financially privileged, a lot of first-generation students, but they've got a big Stanford sticker on them now. They're fine. Well, most of them are. But look, everyone's a person. Everyone's alive. We're living in reality. We are now hearing back from people working with vets with PTSD, people working in community colleges, people working with prisoners coming out of prison. Everybody's got to start somewhere. And one of my favorite examples is a woman I work with who's in the food service world. She commutes an hour and a half each direction. She has a 19-year-old son. She's a single mother. She's got an aging mother of her own. She's the sole breadwinner, and she's going to school full time. She's working 50 hours a week. She's commuting 20 hours a week, and she's going to school full time while raising her son by herself.
Are you guys proselytizing? I think you got a mission here, don't you?
Well, we do. And so what does she do? I mean, how much room has she got to design her life? Well, what she actually did is she did accept. Like we talk about, what can I do? And I'll jump to the end. She redesigned her commute. She got her mother, her aging mother, frankly, a lousy job at the same place she works so that she could plop her mother in the car with her and talk to her an hour and a half a day. And that changed both of their lives. That was a big win for her. And eventually, that full-time degree she's getting is going to allow her to change her career and only work one job. So you do what you can.
Here's Kevin, who likes, with planning, modeling, experimentation, and prototyping, what would you say is the role of intuition or what some might call raw inspiration in life design? Is there still a place for the proverbial blinding flash of light among today's innovative leaders?
Absolutely. And the way you get to the blinding flash of intuition is by honing your intuition. David Brooks, in his book, The Social Animal, talks about how you can educate your emotions and educate your intuition. Designers work off of intuition a lot because, again, when you're dealing with an aesthetics issue or something else, there's no one answer, and you have to find it in a sort of intuitive process. So you train your intuition, and you pay it more attention to it than we normally do in Western society in our method. And part of that is because you're doing things and you're observing their result, and you don't always go to the spreadsheet. Sometimes you just work, you know, from the heart.
And that's Bill Burnett, Executive Director of the Design Program at Stanford and co-author with Dave Evans, who's also with us in the studio, of Designing Your Life. And let me go to more of your calls. Let's go to Lee. Lee, you're on.
Hello, good morning. I really like the premise of this book, and I want to be a true believer, but I'm having some trouble because, having lived and worked with designers most of my life, I do know that there's a direct relationship between or a desired direct relationship between intentionality and outcome, and that's also the premise here that I'm hearing. Correct me if I'm wrong. The trouble is, so much of life is so messy and doesn't fit into that sort of direct path way of working. And I just wonder, how do you account for that? Or is that something that you just ignore in order to, you know, for the will to triumph, so to speak?
We just couldn't agree more. Intentionality, yes. But it's not – by applying design thinking is not a magic wand. You're not going to – because I've designed it, it will now happen. The first step in the design process is accept. You have to live in reality, and it's fully a mess. And so when messes occur, you want to adapt in real time. You can't necessarily have what you want, but you can have what's available. We're trying to give people tools to have the best available life.
But there's a lot of blindsiding.
There's a lot of – we actually do an exercise in the class where people suddenly pretend to be 25 years older than they now are, and they're talking to each other as though they're at a cocktail party, haven't seen each other. Gosh, Michael, it's 2041. It's been so long. I mean, how's the show going? And then we hand them a card that says, oh, by the way, here's a life event you didn't know about. You know, your wife got transferred to Beijing or something like that. You have to live in reality. Bill does this every morning when he shaves.
Yeah, well, I say the positive psychology says –
is it a razor or electric?
It's a razor, and it's the positive psych. I say, you know, have an affirmation in the morning. So I say I live in the best of all possible worlds, because what other world could I live in?
Ontologically, that's
ontologically,
true.
Yeah. And then and everything I do today, I choose to do. Now, I may have to choose to react to some bad situation. You know, somebody could run into my car, or somebody in my family could get sick. I think having that's why we say have three plans, not one. You know, that there are more lives happening than you can plan.
You also believe, like Whitman, that there are many selves involved.
There are many selves, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, am I expressing my poet self or my engineer self today? Am I expressing, you know, just the person who's got to get some bad stuff done because it's got to get done? I think we really do agree with the caller that life is messy. And that having an improvisational approach, a design approach, might be, more effective than trying to, you know, kind of engineer every step and then discover it doesn't work anyway.
Here's Jeff. Jeff, thank you for waiting. You're on the air. Jeff?
Yeah, hello.
Yeah, go
hello?
Ahead. Yes, you're on. Please.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for your time. I would just like to say that probably my background and what's happened to me in my life fits right into what you're talking about. A long time ago, I designed a product that I licensed to Herman Miller, and it went into the Museum of Modern Art. And I chose along the way not to do anything else based on my experience and looking at design in a larger view, in a bigger picture, if you will. Not being so microscopic and, you know, thinking about, putting something else on the market and making money, but actually looking at design in a bigger, broader way. I would also fall into this idea of luck, where I went out and I made something happen and luck came into play. So that's my comments on it, just that as people are designing something, is look at the bigger picture, that design is very important and has a lot of ramifications other than aesthetics.
Yeah. Well, thank you for the call. Good to hear from you. And here's Helena, interesting tweet. How hard was it to turn the Stanford course into an actual book? What was the process?
It was awful. Well, I avoided it for 2 years. Bill made me do it.
Yeah. Dave doesn't like to write. I like sitting in a dark room and talking to myself. Dave can't stand it. We divided the book up into 10 chapters because there was 10 weeks in a quarter. And then we kind of transcribed every lecture and then we looked at it and we said, this is a terrible book. No one's going to read this. Then we got a great agent who helped us really structure the book in a way that was much more readable.
We built a team with people who knew what they were doing.
Yeah, we built a team. And so it took us about 2 years total, a year to write the bad one and another year to write the better one. It was our first experience as an author. I had a fantastic experience where the book was due in August of 2014.
It's pretty clear you get along well and like each other too, which is important. I know co-authors who, you know, were at each other's throats, or co-teachers for that matter, who are at each other's throats.
Pick your co-author very carefully.
And we'll go to a caller, and let's go next to Matt, who's joining us. Morning, Matt.
Hey, good morning. My comment is, I was just thinking about some of the assumptions that are made early on, like, you know, look at becoming a computer programmer or studying philosophy. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about our friends over in Europe who have all these different sort of experiences and different trades and different things they expose the young people to before they even get to kind of college level. And just thinking, is that coming to play as far as helping kids and young people figure out what they're going to do and more like, you know, experience is kind of the best teacher, in my opinion. I'm a mechanical engineer by degree, but I'm a general contractor by profession. And once I got my experience, I started to get a little traction, started figuring out what I really wanted to do, I think. Just wanted to put that on the table for the discussion.
Yeah, thank you for that, Matt.
Yeah, I think it's a great example. I mean, I got a mechanical engineering degree, but you know what I really like to do is like to build stuff, and I want to build stuff at scale. So I'm a general contractor. Why not? In fact, I think we're totally underinvested in the trades in this country. There are fantastic jobs in the trades, and everybody's trying to, you know, write code. And most people who want to write code will never, you know, end up being a programmer. So you're right. Europe does a better job of exposing students to all those other opportunities other than simply getting a college degree. Unfortunately, Europe also, you know, kind of tracks them when they're 14 and then they don't get any more choices. So we're all for choice. And, you know, I've got plenty of students who graduate with a design degree who go off to do something completely different. So this notion that it's tightly linked is not true.
You know, a lot of our students are students who've taken a gap year. You know, it's a small percentage of students who stop out for a year and go try the world on and then come back and finish their education. But the mindset of a student who does that aligns well with, you know, I think I'd like to learn how to invent myself, and they end up taking our classes. Every one of these young men and women, you know, will look back on that gap year and said, best thing I ever did. So getting a little more of reality as well as academy into your experience in your 20s, good idea.
Talking with Dave Evans and Bill Burnett, co-authors of Designing Your Life. And let's go to San Ramon and welcome another caller, Eloy Kumar. Good morning.
Hi. My name is Ajoy. I have a quick question regarding the school kids with the Common Core standards, which currently being challenged by the current president, which is going to be changed. And how is this going to affect the IQ levels and a new level of thinking, design thinking, especially in the liberal arts choices and other programs with kids with the special needs. How is this design thinking going to help them?
Either you want to comment on that?
Well, I can't comment so much on the Common Core curriculum debate because I don't, you know, I'm not an expert at that. But we have a K-12 program at the D School, our Institute for Design at Stanford, and we're working with, you know, hundreds and hundreds of schools across the country in low-income situation and challenging situations, and charter schools and other ones, trying to bring this idea of an innovation curriculum into schools as early as possible, you know, middle school and high school. We've got labs in some middle schools, you know, with all the 3D printers and laser cutters and builder stuff, because that's very popular now, and using that kind of methodology to teach anything, teach English, teach math, teach physics, teach biology, is really catching on in schools, because I think it keeps that in that sort of creative spark in the kids a little longer.
You know, a lot of people want to sort of bring forward questions that you would answer that they're in kind of a cul-de-sac now and they don't know which way to go and all those sorts of things. I'm sure you get that from your students. It's put you in the role of being savants or gurus or something along those lines. And what you're trying to do is just show them how they can find the tools and design. There's a listener here who says, Julie writes, the premise that there is a fancy academic way to figure out life is what's wrong with our culture. In my day, this was called getting out into the working world and trying and, yes, failing and getting back up again.
She's right.
She's right. We agree.
Yeah. Okay. Go, Debbie.
Here is Georgia, who says, we're coming to the close of the hour here, but she wants to know, how might design thinking bring more meaning into one's own life and be expanded into the realm of social entrepreneurship? Is this a connection that can be made, and what would it take?
Oh, we've got a bunch of our students working in the social entrepreneurship space. A shout out to Catapult Design, Heather Fleming, who's working on Indian reservations and other places trying to create change through design thinking. And DREV, which is a company working in India and China and other places in rural environments, trying to bring, you know, small-scale energy systems and other things to those people. So design thinking is being employed in social entrepreneurship all over the country, and we got a great class in that as well.
Well, we'll have to end it there, although somebody wants to know if you're going to give a class in continuing ed. Not for the present.
Come to the website. You'll find out more.
All right. It's a good suspenseful way to end. Thank you, Dave Evans, and thank you, Bill Burnett. Again, their book is Designing Your Life. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated in the evening, 10 to 11. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg, and Jeremy Siegel. Engineer is Katie McMurrin. Engagement editor is Amanda Stupai. And we get online support from Amanda Font. Our interns are Maxine Sheffer-Wolf and Brandon Yu. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our executive producer is Joanne Wallace. Thank you for being a part of this morning's program, and for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.